Oh, sorry. Is there anyone who's new here this week? Got a few people who are new. Okay, excellent. Okay, so look, just please, if you've got any questions, do ask. But we're just going to be doing some chanting, and these are very common devotions that are recited in the Buddhist tradition, especially in the Theravada Buddhist tradition. We'll be reciting in the Pali language. You can see the translation there, and Pali is the language that the Buddha spoke, and which our canon is preserved. And so these are chants which are recited regularly throughout the Theravada Buddhist world. So that means like Thailand, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, as well as many other countries throughout Asia and around the world. So if you're ever visiting a temple in any of those places or an organization or community, and then they start chanting, then you can join in and chant along. And they'll think, wow, they really must know what they're doing. Yeah, there's a real expert there. So they'll be very impressed. So that's why we're doing these chants, and it's really nice to get in contact with that with that lineage and that tradition. So please do chant along. If you're not sure how things supposed to be pronounced, just mumble along and hope for the best. That's how we all learned. Okay, Nilushi. Ah, yes. Thank you for that. Yeah, please grab the newbies guide. Okay. Natalia said, "Bhante, your video is off." Sorry, sorry, Natalia, that's just my face. Okay. Moving along, moving along. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandipiko akaiko ehipasiko opanaiko pachata veditabu Vinyuhiti Supatipanno Bhagavato Sahavaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Sahavaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Sahavaka Sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Atha purisa pungala
Esa Bhagavato Sahavaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakhineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttaram Punyaketam Lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. All right, so shall we do some meditation?
Yes.
Yes, okay, great. Anyone who doesn't want to do any meditation, just don't worry, just sit there and do nothing.
That's very Madhya Marka way of looking at things. Nothing.
Is there anyone here who's new to meditation? Anyone who's never meditated before? No, everyone's done some meditation. Great. You're starting here. Excellent. Thank you. That's the correct answer. You win tonight. All right, so to begin meditation, just to remind ourselves of the basics, we need to have a posture to meditate in. Most of us are sitting on chairs or we can sit on the floor, and our posture should be even and balanced and upright. We have a place to meditate in. So here we are in the Crow's Nest Community Center. It's a pretty good place to meditate, I have to say, all things considered. For those of you who are at home, hopefully you have a suitable place that you can meditate in as well. We have a period of time to meditate in. So today we'll be meditating for about 20 minutes or so. And during that time, our meditation is all that matters. Okay? And then we also have a sense of purpose, which means that we know what it is that we're going to be doing when we meditate. And so our purpose for this meditation is we're going to be developing, how about we do some metta meditation? Does that sound good? We can do some loving kindness meditation. What do you reckon? Is there any good? Anyone who hates love? Metta's hard, okay. Love hates you? No. No, that's not right. That's horrible. Okay. Let's see if we can make it a bit easier. So as always in Buddhism, or as often in Buddhism, the ideas or the values that we're talking about are things which are very common, very normal. And the fact that the Buddha said that we should develop love for each other is not unique, but what is unique is the method which the Buddha established to be able to develop this in meditation and his expectations about what this could do and what it could bring for us. So when we meditate, the focus of our meditation is on the feeling, and the feeling of love. And this is something that we learn to identify inside ourselves. Now, this is very personal, all right? How you experience it is different for every person in this room. But when you experience it, you will know, and there will come this sense of confidence, this sense of joy. And meditation has this peculiar quality of having this virtuous feedback effect. So the more that you ground yourself on the basics of the meditation and the more that you perceive the metta that is there, then the more that will feed back and stabilize and strengthen itself. In fact, that's the basic mechanism of how meditation works. Now, when we're doing a meditation on, let's say, mindfulness of breathing, we are meditating on something which is already there. The breath is already there and we're paying attention to it. The same thing is true for love, right? Love is already there. It's already in your heart. I mean, sure, yeah, it comes and goes, and sure, it may, you know, you may feel that it's gone or whatever, but the reality is that the human heart is nurtured and made whole by love, and the fact that we are here and the fact that we have care for others and we have a sense of morality and we have compassion, it tells us that we actually do have metta in our hearts. That's why this meditation works. We're not trying to magic something out of nowhere. It's just something which is already present and which we are going to bhavana. We're going to develop, make more of, cultivate it, nurture it. That's what the meditation on loving kindness is, like the nurturing of loving kindness. So in this meditation, we are just going to do a short meditation, okay? Meditation is unfathomably profound. For now, we're just going to do a little bit, and we're going to start with metta for ourselves, okay? And I want you all to understand that you deserve to be loved. And if there's anyone in your life that's ever told you otherwise, you tell them, come and see me, okay? I'll give them a right talking to, okay? Because everyone deserves to be loved. This really is fundamental. So not only do you deserve to be loved, but you are capable of developing this meditation. It may take time. You may think that you're not getting anywhere. Don't worry about that. The love that is already inside you can be grown, and that is the fundamental message of the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. So for today, we're just going to do an abbreviated meditation, love for ourselves, and then love for all sentient beings, okay? Because we're going to be talking about space, so we're going to see if we can fill space with love. Okay? We'll see how that goes. All right? When I was in a monastery in Thailand at Wat Nanachat, we actually got a letter one time. This is in the early 90s. Somebody wrote us a letter saying that they wanted to sponsor a monk who was an expert in metta meditation to go up into space to spread metta to the aliens so that they didn't invade us. Right? So we had to write back to them and apologize and say, look, this sounds like a great idea, except unfortunately it works just as well from the surface of the earth, so you can't really justify going to space for that. Anyway, okay, let's begin. So sitting quietly. Letting your mind settle back into the body. and noticing the feelings and emotions that you're experiencing in your heart. And as you keep your mind focused in your heart, say to yourself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And when your mind wanders off worrying about this and that, just be aware of it. Ah, okay. Come back. May I be happy? May I be happy? May I be happy? And your mind, when you're doubting or worrying, don't worry about it. Come back to the thing that really matters, and that is that your deep, fundamental inner wish to be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Saying the words clearly and distinctly to oneself. Be firm and unambiguous. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Notice that as you continue, along with the words of metta, there's something else. And that's the feeling of metta. It's a soft, gentle feeling, a warm glow of love that you feel in your heart. Now taking that same feeling and spreading it through your whole body so that every part of your body from the top of your head to the soles of your feet is soaked through with beautiful, warm, loving kindness. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Now taking that metta and spreading it out across the whole universe. Radiating. Emanating. Sending that warm, beautiful love to all beings. May all beings in the universe be happy. May all beings in the universe be happy. May all beings in the universe be happy. Now coming back to doing metta for oneself. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go. Letting the feeling of metta fade away. And allowing the mind to come back to a neutral space. Empty, open and clear. And with the mind open and clear, take a minute to reflect back over the meditation we've just done together, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what just happened? What did my mind feel like when we began the meditation? What kind of emotions were in my heart? And then, how did that change during the meditation? What's it like now? Do I feel emotionally different than I did at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. How's it all going now? Feeling a bit better? Mm-hmm. Yes, I see a few people smiling. Excellent, that's nice. Good. Let's have a break. Grab a cup of tea, a bit of a chat, and we'll come back for some Dhamma talk. As always, if you can turn your cameras on, it's nice, and we can see you. Hi, Venerable Niroda. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Megan. and a special hello to... Special hello to... Just seeing 1 minute ago. Ah, special hello to Melanie and Marion. Good to see the sisters together. Okay. All right, here we're going. Okay, so I'm going to give a talk about the Buddhist philosophy of space and a Buddhist moral philosophy of space particularly. And I'm going to... give a brief summary of what the talk I'm going to give. First of all, I'm going to talk about what the Buddha has said about space, and I'm going to argue that the Buddha gave us enough information to ground a coherent moral philosophy of space on what the things that the Buddha said. Secondly, I'm going to look at the history of the moral philosophy of space. In other words, I'm going to look at why we think about space the way that we do, why we have the values about it that we do today. And then I'm going to look at the current situation and what is actually going on with space. Speaking of which, we just had a little bit of that current situation wash up on Australian beaches just last week, right? So if you want a summary of what that current situation is, it's that the billionaires play their games and we clean up their mess. So that's pretty much it. And then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about the psychological and existential consequences of that whole situation, if I can. And so this talk is going to be a bit longer than my normal talk, so relax, okay? Just take it easy, okay? We'll get there, and I'm going to take my time touring around space, okay? But anyway, let's begin with the Buddhist context on space, okay? So there's, I think, 4 statements that the Buddha made, or 4 ideas we find in the early Buddhist scriptures that are particularly relevant. First thing is about the notion of world systems, or as we call loka dhatu. So the Buddha spoke about the aneka satasahasani loka dhatu, the countless hundreds of thousands of world systems. Kind of an astonishing idea. And the idea is that each of those world systems is pretty much like our world system. There's a sun and an earth and moons and all of those kinds of things. So the basic idea in the Buddhist scriptures, quite explicitly, is that the whole universe, that is the world as a whole, also called the loka or cosmos, is made up of these countless world systems. Now, in fact, the word that we use for world in Pali is loka, and the original meaning of loka is a light. So it actually was originally meant the points of light that we see in the sky, aka the stars. And so from there is the lights, specifically the lights of heaven, or just the lights in general. And then it became to be generalized that, oh, this world is another light. So we're like a light to them, just as they are to us. Yeah. And so from the beginning, this idea that we are part of a vast cosmos in which there are sentient beings like us. This is foundational to Buddhism. It's a basic assumption in Buddhism. And I should mention that it's not really peculiar to Buddhism as such, and similar ideas are found in Hinduism and Jainism, so it should be understood to be a general Indian cultural idea. So there's world systems and planets and everything like that full of aliens, okay? But we don't call them aliens in Buddhism. We call them sentient beings because they are like us. They just happen to be somewhere else, right? And that idea that the universe is full of life and therefore is worth valuing and worth cherishing, right? Again, these are foundational notions in Buddhism. But we are not special. We are not better than them. But there's another key idea to this. Another key idea is that each of those loka dhatu also has heavens and hells. Now, think what you like about heavens and hells. Are they real? Are they not? Are they metaphors? Whatever. That's not the point at this point in time. The point is that these are moral worlds, right? The heavens and hells are dimensions created and driven by moral choices, aka karma. So that means that each of those worlds is full of creatures who do good things and do bad things, and they experience suffering and they experience happiness, and that's why their lives are valuable. Even it's the case that they might at some point seek an escape from good and evil and an escape from suffering and find liberation. And there could even be Buddhas in those other realms all around the universe. Yeah? Hopefully there are. So from a Buddhist point of view, we have never seen ourselves, we've never seen our world or our status as sentient beings or even our status as followers of the Buddha as being unique in the universe. That there is a pattern of how things work, we call the Four Noble Truths or dependent origination. And just as the physicist will say that the laws of physics are universal, then on all of those worlds, gravity applies and all of those things. And the same thing, the Four Noble Truths apply. Not because the Buddha somehow made it that way, but because the observations that the Buddha made are applicable widely whenever there are sentient beings who suffer. So this is the first thing to consider, right? That the universe is full of sentient beings whose lives are valuable in and of themselves. That's number one. Second point that we can learn from what the Buddha said on space is that there is a lot of nothing between here and there. Okay? Again, this might kind of seem obvious, right? But there's a lot of nothing. And the Buddha spoke about the vast interstellar reaches of intergalactic space. And this is, something that that has these consequences. Basically, it means that most of the world is made up of nothing, more or less, right? The space between things. Now, the Buddha didn't speak too much about that, but Buddhist commentaries say that cold space is one of the hell realms. Right? And it's possible for sentient beings to be reborn in that space, in the howling abyss of nothingness. Okay, I think we can all agree that that would, in fact, be hellish if we were reborn there. And if you think it's impossible to be reborn there, I will refer you to the Wikipedia article on Boltzmann brains. Okay? I'm not going to explain Boltzmann brains. You can look it up yourselves, okay? But Boltzmann brains. Okay? Moving on. So that's number one. The worlds that are the light where life lives, the space, which is the black void between them. Then the next detail that we find in the suttas about space is about rohitasa. And many of you may know, I've spoken about rohitasa a number of times in the past, but very briefly, rohitasa is mentioned in one sutta, and he is a deity. His name means red horse. And he is the deity who embodies the red horses of the dawn. that leap across the sky when the sun comes over the mountains. And the Buddha said that he moved faster and further than any other being. And he gave the measurement for how fast does a beam of light shoot across the sky. And the measurement is that it flies across the width of the shadow of a palm tree as fast as a swift arrow shot across the shadow of a palm tree. In the same time, he would take a stride across the whole breadth of India. So because we know all of those numbers, we know how wide a palm tree is, we know how fast an arrow flies, we know how wide India is, we can plug those numbers in, and the number that comes out is 300,000 kilometers per second. So that's how fast a sunbeam goes, according to the suttas, 300,000 kilometers per second, which, whether by coincidence or not, is the speed of light.
3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second.
Yeah. That's it. So anyway, one of the points about that particular sutta is that you can travel at that speed and you still don't get to the end of the universe, which of course we also know from physics as well. And basically the idea that traveling at that speed is kind of futile. Like, you're not going to answer the questions that you're going to want, right? You travel and you travel and you travel, and it's just more space. And so the Buddha said, actually, the space in here is what we need to investigate. And this is where you find the real world that's worth investigating. So this also is from the Buddha's text, that the speed of light is this limit on space, on travel, and that you're not going to get anywhere even if you can travel at the speed of light. Then finally is the fourth point. So we've so far had the many world systems, we've had the blackness of interstellar space, we've had the speed of light, and the last one is that if you think too much about the universe, you'll go mad. Okay, this also is like very interesting. It's one of the things you read about in the suttas, and you think it's actually really interesting because there's a lot, like it's a big theme in like modern like art and contemplation about space, right? I mean, we could all think of examples, right? In space, no one can hear you scream, right? Or this is Major Tom to ground control, I'm stepping through the door. Or set the controls for the heart of the sun. Or so many different examples where our sort of modern imagination tells us that an encounter with space can be something that drives us mad. And I just want to make a note here that when I'm using the word mad here, I'm not talking about a mental illness. I'm talking about, I was giving some thought to this and saying, what do we actually mean by this? And I think what I mean is something like a monstrous irrationality, a gulf between like where we are and how the world is and how we operate within that world, which becomes dysfunctional and destructive when it goes to these extremes. And this is when I'm talking about the madness that comes from space, this is really what I'm meaning. So that idea that space drives you mad, also found in the suttas, probably, I'm going to guess, probably the first time that that idea was ever suggested. I don't know. We could do a historical analysis, but there's many things. I want to make a list of like all the things that Buddhism did first, because there's lots of things that we're not properly acknowledged for. Mountaineering, fashion design. Yes, come on, man. So many things. So these are the four points that we can find in the suttas, in the Buddha's original teachings, that I think provide us with quite a rich basis for understanding our own relation to space today, even though obviously the situation's changed. And, you know, I'm pointing out correlations with physics and things like that, but obviously it's not identical. I'm not trying to argue that. But there is enough similarity for us to be able to see how to give meaning to our choices in that context. All right, so that's a foundation for a Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist moral philosophy of space. So next point in the talk I'm going to talk about is like, well, what is the moral philosophy of space that we are actually using? Because it's certainly not the Buddhist one. And a few weeks ago, so hopefully some of you were here, I gave a talk about Nikolai Fyodorov. Was anyone here for that talk about the Russian cosmist? A few of you were here. I'm not going to assume that everyone was here for that. But I'll briefly sum up Fyodorov. So he was a Russian philosopher in the 19th century, late 19th century, who was kind of an astonishing person. Like his personal qualities, his intelligence, his kindness and gentleness were all remarked on by everyone. And he developed a rather extraordinary philosophy about humanity and space. Fyodorov was deeply Christian, and in his writings, he's referring to the Trinity and Christ and so on constantly. Like he wasn't vaguely inspired by Christianity. He's constantly referring to these things. And he believed that humanity has a common task. Very briefly, the common task was that we were obligated, morally obligated, to achieve immortality for ourselves and to resurrect all of our ancestors so that they could also live immortally, and then to colonize the galaxy and populate all the worlds in the galaxies with our ancestors. Yes, Mel.
I'm just going like this.
Right? Right, and so this is someone who, like people like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and so on, were saying, "Oh, yeah, I agree with everything he's saying," and so on. He was very influential at the time. Now, this is one of the first examples of what I would call that madness. Again, a kind of a monstrous irrationality. The difference between where he was and what he was talking about. And one of the reasons why I talked about Fyodorov was because much of his thought is very similar to the philosophy or cluster of philosophies known today as Tescreel. So again, very briefly on Tescreel, which I've spoken about a number of times before, this was an acronym proposed by Timnit Gebru and Emil Torres a few years ago to describe the philosophies that are dominating the values of the tech industry. And it's important to understand this because most of us, I believe, when we think about the tech industry and what they're doing, we still think that what are they doing? They're all about making money. They're all about doing these things. We understand them in terms of how we understood capitalism in the past. And I think that's deeply misleading because to them, money is just an implementation detail. They don't actually care. What they want is something that is much deeper and much stranger. Yeah. So Tescreel refers to things like transhumanism, extropism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism, all of which are prefigured in Fyodorov's work in one way or another. So this, I think, is quite extraordinary. When Gimnit and Torres made their... Gebru and Torres made their paper, they identified the unifying feature of the Tescreel philosophies was eugenics, that these things always come back to some people have to live and some not, right? The idea that we have to improve our gene pool through, well, the right kind of people have to be living, okay? I'll allow you to just speculate and guess about what the right kind of people might be. But anyway, I was thinking about this in the context of Fyodorov because Fyodorov doesn't seem to be a eugenicist as far as I've seen in his writings. But he's an immortalitist, right? He wants everybody to live forever, an eternalist, as we would say from a Buddhist point of view. And I think that these two are flip sides of the same thing, right? Quest for immortality, some must live, and so that others must die. So that some must live, so that others must die. I feel like these are two sides of the same thing. So that was one insight that I got from looking at Fyodorov, and the other insight was how deeply Christian these ideologies are. the whole idea of resurrection of the dead so we can live forever. I mean, it's kind of weird, right? But this was central to Fyodorov's thought, and it's central to the idea of colonizing the galaxy. And this is another key insight that I got from Fyodorov. The primary reason why he's thinking about space is so that we can colonize it. That's it. It's not exploration. It's not understanding. It's none of these things. The main motivation is so that all of our dead ancestors, zombie-like, can go into space and live on zombie planet. And he can say, I'm going to read briefly a couple of excerpts from Fyodorov. I got a couple of bits from him, just so you can get a flavor of his writing. So obviously this is an English translation from the Russian. So one of the things he says here, global communications by land and sea, rail and ship require energy, past energy received by the planet and embodied in coal, peat and the like is insufficient to maintain unifying communications among the inhabitants of the Earth. So use will have to be made of the force which gives rise to storms, hurricanes and so on. This is kind of interesting. He's writing in the late 19th century, and he's saying fossil fuels will be inadequate, so we will have to use solar energy. He doesn't use the word solar energy, but that's clearly what he's referring to. Kind of interesting, right? This is the thing with Fyodorov. He's very insightful in many ways, but then he takes these kind of next steps that make you go, I'm not quite going to follow you on that one. Okay. So then he says, a united humanity will become the consciousness of the planet Earth and of its relationships with other heavenly bodies. Okay, so a few concepts there. A united humanity, right? How are we going to achieve a united humanity? All united by being Christian, of course, right? Will be the consciousness of the planet Earth. This idea of the consciousness of the planet Earth is also... like, this is a huge idea still in Russian cosmist philosophy. They have this idea of the noosphere, a sphere of consciousness around the Earth. It was informed when Jack Dorsey sold Twitter to Elon Musk, and he said, Elon Musk is the person I singularly entrust with the vision of spreading the light of consciousness to the universe. So this is the same informing ideology that we have this consciousness. They don't mean consciousness the same thing that we mean consciousness, right? That means awareness. Consciousness is something like the sum total of thoughts of humanity as found in the Twitter database or something. I'm not quite sure how that goes. Anyway, Fyodorov discusses Buddhism and he criticizes Buddhism and rejects it. We're talking late 19th century Russia, okay? He didn't know that much about it, so that's fine. But I think it is interesting that he explicitly rejected Buddhism. And I think he was quite right to do so. His philosophy is quite different to the Buddhist philosophy. So then he says, goes on to say... our sun is dimming, however slowly, and we are right to say that the hour will come when it will no longer give light, that the time is at hand. The extinction of stars, sudden or slow, is an instructive example, a terrifying warning. The growing exhaustion of the soil, the destruction of forests, distortions of the meteorological process manifested in floods and droughts, all this... again, he's talking about the environmental devastation that he was seeing in Russia in the 19th century. This also you find in Dostoevsky as well. All of this forebodes famines and plagues and prompts us to heed the warning. I'm not disagreeing with anything so far. Apart from a slowly advancing end, we cannot be certain whether a sudden catastrophe may not befall the Earth, this tiny grain of sand in the vastness of the universe. And yet, planet Earth is perhaps the only bearer of salvation, and the other millions of worlds merely nature's unsuccessful attempts.
Wow, how can you make that claim?
Okay. So giving a really a nice example of like Fyodorov, on the one hand, he was actually very environmentalist. He was actually really concerned about nature and everything. But also this weird salvation thing, like we have to say it, solve everyone. So this is how he solves that problem of like what happens if we go to those other worlds and there's somebody already there, right? They don't have salvation, i.e. they don't have the word of Jesus Christ. So, okay. This is one, well, if it was one person's belief, I wouldn't have a problem. It's his belief. My argument, though, is that it's actually the belief which is informing the space industry as it's run today. So that's, we'll get onto that. The prejudice that the celestial expanse is unattainable to man has grown gradually over the centuries, but cannot have existed from the beginning. Only the loss of tradition and separation of men of thought from men of action gave birth to this prejudice. So he sees this idea that we're separated from the other worlds as being just a prejudice. However, for the Son of Man, the celestial worlds are the future homes of the ancestors, since the skies will be attainable only to the resurrected and the resurrecting. The exploration of outer space is only the preparation for these future dwelling places. Okay, again, he's very explicit about this. The exploration of outer space is only so that we can settle our resurrected ancestors there. Okay, and
So outer space was a term in the 1800s.
How did he imagine resurrecting the ancestors? From what?
he's got a whole thing about how to resurrect the ancestors. Yeah, he would be arguing that physically we always leave traces. And so, you know, maybe cloning from DNA or whatever. But he would then say you could then infer from DNA. I don't know if he would talk about DNA. He wouldn't talk about DNA as such, but the idea would be you can infer from one person's DNA, like what their ancestors were, and then use that for... And look, I'm not going to try and justify that. What is more fantastic? To create a moral society by postulating the existence of other beings in other worlds, right? And envisaging the emigration thither of souls, the existence of which cannot be proven, right? So this is essentially the Buddhist idea, right? That there are other beings in other worlds. Or to transform this transcendental migration into an imminent one. That is, to make such a migration the goal of human activity. Okay? So again, this is his common task. It's not merely the fact that there's this possibility. He's saying that this is the essential moral task of humanity. So this is Nikolai Fyodorov writing in the late 19th century. And that book I'm reading from is available on Internet Archive, so check it out if you're interested. Lee says, you sounded like a priest. Thanks for that, Lee. I'll go away and reconsider my life's choices now. Now, Fyodorov has had many students and inspired many different people. I've just got some notes here because I've got some things like Russian names that I'm going to have to read because otherwise. So one of his students was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. Apologize if there's any Russians present. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. And again, as I mentioned in the previous talk, but very briefly, in 1903, he published a paper where he published the first blueprint of a multi-stage ballistic missile for going to space. So he was just like sitting in some hut in the middle of a forest, thinking about these things, drawing diagrams, and he did all of the engineering and physics and figured out how much fuel you need, what is the energy density. He said we have to use compressed hydrogen for doing the fuel. We'll have to have a three-stage ballistic missile. In the top stage will be a capsule. That's where the astronauts are. We'll have airlocks. He did a design for the airlocks and all of these things. He basically designed the modern space rocket sitting in a hut in the middle of Russia in 1903. Kind of wild. So again, these guys were quite serious. They're not just messing around. Now, that was 1903. Now, in 1905, okay, there was some bad news. Okay? In fact, a real bummer. A young German physicist, who you may have heard of, Albert Einstein, mm-hmm. published his work on the special theory of relativity and essentially, among other things, showed that we're not going to go faster than the speed of light. Confirming, of course, the Rohitasa Sutta. I don't know if he knew about it, but anyway. And I should mention, by the way, that historical researchers say that he developed his ideas together with his then wife, whose name was on the original draft of that paper, but was not on the published draft. So there you go. Okay, so once we've established the speed of light, right, then it immediately means we are never going to another star system, full stop. It's just not going to happen. And if you are a science fiction fan, who's a science fiction fan here? Yes, okay, great way. That's how you understand the world we're living in, right, because all of these tech bros and so on are all science fiction fans and they're all out building their stuff. You know, if you want to understand the modern tech bros' relationship to science fiction, the best example I read was years ago. I read an interview with a guy who was running this high-class restaurant in New York or something, and he said, like, what were you inspired by? And he said, I was inspired to become a chef by seeing the movie Soylent Green. So in the movie Soylent Green is a food product that everybody eats, and the famous line from the movie is Soylent Green is people. So he was inspired by Soylent Green because in there, there's this elite class who eats all the really delicious food all the time while everybody else is eating people. And he saw the movie and thought, I want to be one of them. So, yeah, if you want to understand Tech Bro's relationship to science fiction, that sums it up pretty well. Anyway, moving along. So in science fiction, we have hyperspace and we have warp drives and we have, what else do we have? Quantum tunnels, and we have wormholes and all of these things, all of which are magic. None of them are actually real, and they're things that sound sciencey, but they're not actual science. And there's no actual way for humans to go to another star system. It's simply never going to happen. In fact, the speed of light isn't even really the issue, because we're not even getting close to the speed of light, practically speaking. So really, that should have been the end of this whole cosmos idea, but it wasn't. So in the 1920s, a young German science nerd became really interested in Tsiolkovsky. I'm having flashbacks to my days reading The Brothers Karamazov and trying to make my way around all the Russian names in it. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. Okay. A young... A German guy interested in physics and so on read Tsiolkovsky and others and became really interested in rocket science. His name was Werner von Braun, and he became the leader of the Nazi rocket science attempt, and they built the V2 rocket. And so that was essentially based on Tsiolkovsky's designs or his basic ideas. And the V2 was built by slaves. This was in the later years of the Nazi regime, when most of their work was now being done by slaves. So they built that. They used it for attacking England and so on, and they proved that the idea was possible. When the war ended, the Americans said, out of moral principle, we're not going to have anything to do with Nazis. No, hang on, that's not what happened. The Americans said, we're going to nab all of these Nazi scientists and put them to work on our missile development. And so when Brown went to America and a bunch of others, and they started developing rocket science in America. Important just to notice this pedigree. I think these things matter. I think the actual response to Nazi science should have been to say, we won't have anything to do with Nazi science. If there's something valuable there, we can work it out. So, I mean, it's not as if America is incapable of doing things by itself, right? Anyway, so they developed rockets in America. Interesting, also a little factoid, Wernher von Braun wrote one novel where he gave a realistic account of settling Mars. And on Mars, the leader of Mars, his name was the Elon. I don't know. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know. I don't know. Destiny. I don't know. Anyway. Fine. So he started work. So the Americans started work on the space program. The Russians, of course, were doing the same thing. And their space program had two basic wings, two main wings, or their rocket program. Number one, let's go to space and let's go to the moon. Number two, let's build nukes. And they built an absolutely obscene amount of nuclear weapons. The program and the philosophy underlying that was literally called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. And the Americans and the Russians between them built over 70,000 nuclear weapons. 70,000. There's not even close to 70,000 targets that you can hit with a nuclear bomb. Absolutely insane. Like what they did in the 50s and 60s, and if you read the accounts of it, it's like so out of proportion. I mean, it's got no rational defense logic or anything like that. And yet it was pursued on and on and on. And again, this is this thread that I'm trying to point to, where, you know, if you look at Fyodorov, seemed to be like a very, he obviously was a very intelligent and compassionate man, but somehow something went wrong and his thoughts became mad. Same thing with Wernher von Braun working for the Nazis. There's a madness to that. Same thing with America and Russia building all these thermonuclear weapons. There's a madness to it. It's not connected to any kind of reality. And so as well as developing the nuclear weapons, there's also the developing the, you know, going to space, setting up satellites, and ultimately going to the moon, regarded as one of humanity's greatest achievements. Okay, so very briefly, following that time, our relationship to space became more prosaic for the next few decades, I think. Basically, we built a shuttle. It's more like a bus for going up and down, and it's more like, let's use space as a utility. We'll put GPS there. We'll put some satellites there. We can do some things that's useful and so on. But the kind of the heat went out of the space race as the Soviet Union collapsed and so on. And I feel like in recent years that has come back up again, like that we're seeing that resurgence of energy in space and related things, driven primarily by Elon Musk and SpaceX, as well as by Jeff Bezos and others. So I want to now turn to discussing these guys and their aims as well. So one of the reasons why I started thinking about these things was the recent trip to the moon by Artemis II. So they flew back to the moon for the first time since 1972, did a loop, chucked a U-ey around the moon. And then, apologies for the non-Australians present, they chucked a U-ey around the moon and then came back again. And there are a few things about that struck me at the time. First thing was the incredible photography that was done. Oh my goodness, amazing work, yeah. Second thing was there was a short little clip that showed one of the astronauts coming home And when she arrived at her front door, her dog came to greet her, like barking, waving its tail, so happy. And the caption was that Artemis II was the furthest that any human being had been separated from their dog. And there's something about that I thought was very profound and very moving. I began to realize that, like, when we're going into space, we're not just going away from oxygen and from houses. We're also going away from love. And we are leaving love and going into blackness. And I feel like this is maybe one of the sources of that madness that we're talking about. I'm going to come back to that in a little while. Then, so that was two things that struck me. Another thing that struck me was how, okay, so you got all these astronauts, okay? Incredible, right? Their training, professionalism, everything they do is incredible. And there's a clip of them out near the moon having to listen to Donald Trump, who's like WhatsApping them or whatever, and is like, bliviating on, and they're all sitting there, and it's just so awkward and so cringe. And you're like, oh my God, these poor people are having to be subject to this. But the reality is that this whole space resurgence and so on is in fact driven and informed by Donald Trump, specifically by Donald Trump's executive orders on space. And that's something that we can't divide, we can't separate a space exploration mission like Artemis II from Trump's agenda, from who he is as a person and from what he is trying to achieve, as well as, of course, the people who are driving the driver, namely, again, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Jeff Bezos and the like. So I'm going to briefly read another few passages here because I feel that these things are under-recognized. So this is from whitehouse.gov. It speaks of the deployment of nuclear reactors on the moon and in orbit. Just in case you thought you didn't have enough things to worry about. Okay. And in the summary of his Trump's executive orders, he says, it is the policy of the United States to enhance American greatness in space. So again, there are international agreements that are supposed to govern our actions in space, and which speak of working together and working for the good of humanity. And obviously, that's not Trump's agenda. In space, by enabling a competitive launch marketplace. Okay. One thing to understand about these guys, they are profoundly unimaginative. They've literally got one idea, and that's it, and they're going to apply that everywhere. Okay. And substantially increasing commercial space launch cadence. That means more and more rockets into space. And here's the most chilling one, novel space activities. Okay, make what you will of novel space activities. Oh, and how are we going to do that? We are going to eliminate or expedite the Department of Transportation's environmental reviews and other obstacles to the granting of launch and re-entry licenses and permits, okay? So this, Elon Musk was quite clear about this. This was one of the main driving reasons behind his sponsorship of the second Trump administration was to get the EPA out of the way of his space launches. His space launches, especially Starship, but also his other ones, are massively destructive to the environment in all kinds of ways, from the launch pad to the use of fossil fuels. Starship, that's Elon Musk's next generation space vehicle, burns 1,000 tons of methane each launch. And his plan is to build 1,000 of these and have them launch 3 times a day each. So that's 3 million tons of methane every day. That's his aim. That's double. That would double the current global consumption of methane, just so we know the scale of it. He's not going to do that, right? These are just numbers that he just puts out there, right? None of those will be achieved, but you understand like what it is that they're trying to do. Okay, so there was a study on this published through Cambridge International Law Journal, something, just a couple of details from here. The Trump policy is the assertive securitization and commercialization of space together with perfunctory multilateral engagement. And the statements that are most relevant, I think, are from President Trump on the 35th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. He said that we are pursuing our manifest destiny into the furthest depths of the cosmos. Okay? So this kind of language is very significant. Hopefully most of you have heard of the idea of manifest destiny. It was the rationale that the white American settlers used to cross from the East Coast through to California and genocide the indigenous people, enslave black people, and so on. And that was all justified by the idea that we have a manifest destiny to conquer these lands and to live there. And he is now explicitly invoking that to go to the furthest depths of the cosmos. Again, not saying to put satellites into orbit or even to go to the moon, but to the furthest depths of the cosmos. Just to be clear, obviously Donald Trump didn't write this. In his inaugural address, the president pledged the United States would, quote, pursue our manifest destiny into the stars. Right? So this cosmist idea that we heard from Fyodorov is still very much present and very much alive. Now, again, it's kind of mad. Like, there's no plan to do this. It's not going to happen. But this is the founding mission of SpaceX. The purpose of SpaceX is to colonize the galaxy. Everything else they do is a step towards that. Okay? So these are things, are not things that are kind of incidental or random. The point that I'm making here is that when we hear these things, we think, oh, this is just a bit of rhetoric which is being thrown out. But it actually is very revealing of the underlying ideologies and thought processes of these people. Now, one of the things, so just briefly on some of the things that are actually happening or that they're planning to do in space. They're planning to build a golden dome, which is like Israel's Iron Dome, except for America, and made of gold. I don't know. Trump probably thinks it's actually made of gold. I don't know. But it's a golden dome, and it's supposed to protect America and so on. So that means like a massive militarization of space. Yeah? A huge amount of stuff will go in there. Of course, what they will do is not what they say they were going to do, but with the massive acceleration of putting things into space, then we do have to reasonably ask what exactly are they going to do with all that stuff, okay? And again, in my view, the easiest way to understand that is to recognize that these are profoundly unimaginative people and that they are going to do in space the same thing that they've done everywhere else. So that's what's going to inform it. They're going to use it to monopolize. They're going to use it to dominate. They're going to be using it to get everybody's information. They're going to be using it to surveil people. They're going to be using it to put weapons there. We're going to be using it to kill people. All of those same kinds of things that they've done here on Earth, they're going to be doing in space. That's what this space race is about, to establish a globally dominant military surveillance system. Yeah. So when I said I'm going to be talking about space for the Dark Week, a lot of people were saying, but that's, you know, it's more like a fun topic. It's not that dark, but this is especially dark topic because it's something that you thought was fun and now that you think is not. So that's why it's especially dark topic. Okay. Now, there are many, many implications of these. One of them I mentioned before about the environmental implications. So currently, all of this, like Elon Musk Starlink, all of these things are all in low orbit. The thing about things in low orbit is they fall down. That's a normal part of the thing. It's planned into it. They fall down and they're supposed to burn up in the upper atmosphere. What the current estimate is that because meteors are landing in the upper atmosphere all the time anyway, right? So the current atmosphere, the current estimate is that it's a roughly 50-50. The amount of stuff going in the upper atmosphere is about half natural from the meteors and about half from satellites decaying. That's a current situation. So if we're increasing the amount of satellites by 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times, then obviously that's going to change. What's that going to do to the upper atmosphere? I don't know. You don't know. Guess, do you know who else doesn't know? Like literally anyone. There's no science and no serious studies on that. So this is a huge gap in what we're doing. Another problem with that is what's called the Kessler syndrome. Anyone know Kessler syndrome? Kessler effect, Kessler syndrome? Basically, when you get too much stuff in space, things eventually bump into each other. And because they are traveling at like 17,000 kilometers an hour, having a collision is somewhat drastic. There's also no friction. So once they break into bits, they just keep spinning around and then they smash into other satellites and so on. So you can get a chain reaction where the whole satellite belt will rip itself to shreds because of this Kessler effect. And again, nobody really knows. People think that we're on the verge of being dense enough with satellites that the Kessler effect is going to be a real effect, but we don't really know, and we probably won't know until it actually happens. But this is just an example of how when we're putting infrastructure into space, that we are creating all kinds of risks that don't exist when you have, let's say, Wi-Fi on the ground. Right? I mean, just think about it for a minute. If Elon Musk does all of these things, that means what he wants to do is to make Starlink the default internet provider for the whole world. That means the whole internet is going through Starlink servers. All right? I'll let you contemplate the possibilities there. All right. So coming to the end of the talk here, and I want to just give some little reflection on this, and I wanted to focus on that idea of like how that madness or that monstrous irrationality occurs. Bye bye. Okay. So they're talking about manifest destiny. And that is harking back to this American exceptionalism, this idea that that the Americans think that somehow they have the right to take over this land and dominate it. And this, I've always thought that this kind of idea is expressed through like cowboy movies and the Westerns. Like the Western is kind of an origin story for California. The Western is the story that Hollywood told itself about itself to explain why it existed. Hollywood made this dream, this idea that we are here because all of these people searched for this promised land, and they came across, and the power of those who are essentially right triumphed, and those who are essentially right are, of course, the white men with guns who killed everybody else. And because they had an essential rightness to them, they triumphed in coming across the wilderness and reaching that promised land of California. Yeah? And this is like a mythological arc, right? It's a religious story, in fact. And it's telling about not just about how we came to be in this place. It's telling a story ultimately of eugenics, about who lives and who dies, and about why Californians are better than everyone else, why they are the chosen people. Sorry to any Californians present on this talk, but it's because of the time zones are different. There's usually no one from America here, so I can say that. But there's this narcissism, right, this arrogance about the being better, which I believe comes from this eugenicist tradition. And with the way that all of these tech bros are thinking, they're extending that same logic into space, the final frontier. the space western. This is a standard trope in science fiction, right? We're going into space. Han Solo is a cowboy in a bar in space, right? This is how they think about it. It's lawless, right? There's no government. They're the ones who go and through the power of their will and the power of their violence establish law and order, because the people who live there don't matter. What matters is us and the violence that we can exert against them. And this is the story which is being played out through these ideas of adventures in space. The difference is that we actually could go to California. And regardless of all of the horrifying things that were done in getting there, at the end of the day, you can go surfing at Venice Beach and you can go for a walk up in Santa Monica or something like that, and it's quite nice. There's an actual real place to go. So what happens if you have that same story which is animating you, that same drive, that same belief in yourself that I am the one who is going to forge this path across the cosmos? And what happens when you can't do it? What happens when you inevitably fail? Because these things will never actually happen. And that, I think, is the madness. The idea that everything that you're doing is driving towards a goal that is intrinsically unobtainable. Yeah. So to very briefly recap, I talked originally about the Buddhist perspective on space, the idea that there are many worlds, the idea that there is dark space between them, the idea that we can travel at the speed of light and never reach the end of it, and the idea that we will go mad if we think about it too much. And I suggested that these points are all relevant for our understanding of the current situation in regards to space. And I drew the historical connections through the Russian cosmists, through Wernher von Braun, to the American-Russian space race and into the present day. I talked a little bit about the current situation of what's happening in space with the Trump space policy and some of the environmental implications of that. And I offered some reflections about how that madness manifested in terms of the narratives and stories that we believe that we tell ourselves. Hopefully by this time, you can see why I'm talking about a Buddhist moral philosophy of space, that through Buddhist principles, we can have a way of thinking about space that is not mad, that is not monstrously irrational. A way of thinking about space where we can appreciate the exploration, we can appreciate the science, and we can appreciate even the infrastructure and the capacities that satellites and so on will give us, but in a moderate and a modest way, in a balanced way, in a way that isn't driven by this colonialist imperative to go and settle on other places and wipe out the native populations there. And that is not driven by greed, by hatred, and by delusion. So this is some thoughts for you this evening on a Buddhist moral philosophy of space, offering that for your reflection. Any questions or thoughts on that? Kunal.
So thank you, Sadhu Sadhu. Sorry for interrupting earlier. I was willing to make a brief comment that Einstein did have some interaction with Buddhist philosophy and Hindu philosophy as well.
Sure.
To what extent the exact details of that, I personally don't know, but he had familiarity with it, along with other scientists like David Bohm, sure, Oppenheimer, Peter Capra, a few others as well. And they show those parallels with Buddhism and modern Western science.
It would be nice to have a chat with him about it, right?
Only they were alive still. If you try the AI avatars, and that's a joke.
Not a good one, Kunal. Not a good one.
The one to come from Starlink.
Not a good one. Okay, moving along. Okay,
First of all, that was a profound talk. Thank you very much. The question that I had was, you mentioned things like the theory of relativity, the speed of light.
Yep.
if Buddhism has been around for as long as it has and it had some understanding of those concepts,
yeah,
why is the narrative that all of us are familiar with other scientific narratives? I guess my question is, how come Buddhism hasn't caught on more in that time?
How, okay, so the question is, how come if Buddhism had all these insights into space and so on and so forth, then how come Buddhism hasn't caught on more and we know about these things from Western science, okay? Well, I did mention in that talk about this little thing called colonialization. So for the last 1,000 years, Buddhist countries have been invaded, genocided, colonized, massacred by Abrahamic religions from the West. And I'm guessing that there's a large part of the answer for that is right there.
That, yeah. Cosmology was in the Bhagavad Gita.
Similar cosmology, like the Indian cosmology is different in details, but it's shared across the things. Yeah, I actually was doing a bit of research for this, and I found that there was a Western astrologer or astronomer about in the 1600s, 1700s. Who was the first one to make an estimate of the speed of light. And so he did it just by observing the moons of Jupiter and came up with a speed of like 220,000 kilometers per second. So still very much within the ballpark. So the idea that the ancient Indians could have observed the stars and deduced the speed of light is not actually as far-fetched as one might think. Yeah. Yeah. Sumana, yeah.
How about the Russian philosopher Igor?
Yes.
He was thinking he's a narcissist.
Uh-huh.
And then the thing about the common task is the grandeur of things. And just like in movies, we also have common task to aim. Like they still doing the common tasks,
like
especially finish
the task. Right. And the task is to suffering to be saved. Right. And the
spiritual path to be done.
Yep.
So
it's
just, you know.
Yeah, no.
Listen to.
Take some breaths, someone else. Take some breaths, yeah.
So you mentioned about human mind.
Please, yeah, sorry. Sorry, I just wanted to just briefly respond to Anne before going on. But just say thank you for sharing that. And that point that you make is also, I agree with that, the Buddha ended his task rather than it being an ongoing, continuing task. And this being one of those clear points of distinction between Buddhism and Christianity. Yeah. So, sorry, yes, Jacqueline. Jacqueline, right?
Something more practical. So if, say, one rocket launch, release that many methane.
Yeah.
So in calculation, which means how many humans stop eating beef to balance that? I was just talking.
How many humans?
How many humans stop eating beef?
That's a good point. If the rest of humanity, the rest of humanity can stop eating beef so that Elon can have enough methane to be able to fire his rocket ships. I'm sure people will accept that as a nice little suggestion. But look, obviously there are a lot of other things which are driving these things, right? And look, we're living in Australia, and where they have in Western Australia massive new methane proposals, right? Who's using that methane? Where is it actually going? And, you know, we should be, as Fyodorov rightly pointed out in the 19th century, that fossil fuels are inadequate for supporting the needs of a modern society. So why are we still pursuing all of these things? Yeah.
You didn't mention the nuclear explosions in the end of the 50s and early 60s in the outer atmosphere.
Nuclear explosions in the 50s and 60s in the outer atmosphere? Yeah. I didn't even know about that.
They detonated nuclear bombs in the high atmosphere, in the magnetosphere.
And
that was just, to my mind, an act of monstrous hubris. That was, you know, demonstrably capable of destroying the whole world, and maybe has. It's created new magnetic spheres that didn't exist before.
Wow.
Giant, enormous nuclear explosions.
Just because?
Because, yeah. Well, the Russians were doing it, so we had to as well.
Yeah, okay. As mad as you think these things are, it's just matter. Right? Yeah. They're just reading some of the accounts from that time, like the people in Washington were like, what are you people doing over there? Like there was like no oversight. They just had these massive budgets flowing in. And anyway, okay, moving on. Any other questions? I've got a couple on like Nina.
Not so much a question, but just a comment. It's a real shame because the cosmologies and the astronomies of Buddhism and those Eastern traditions were, by my understanding, helping humans
right.
in that liberation, almost like a blueprint or a pathway,
right.
A microcosm,
right.
Macrocosm.
Right.
Even the Western science fiction writers, I really love science fiction when I was young. It had that similar kind of theme to it, inner world exploration alongside and those kind of like moral themes, and all this has been missed.
Right. Right.
It's horrifying.
Right. Yeah, there was a lot of like the early science fiction struggled a lot with these kinds of ideas. but again, I feel like this is another source of that madness, that idea that I mentioned about like coming up against something which is unthinkable. Like I gave that analogy of like the Western arriving in California and then turning your attention to space. But I do think the same thing applies to Christianity as well. Like Christianity has no concept of space, has no concept of worlds or all of those things we were talking about. To Christians, we are singular. We have the salvific message of Jesus Christ. And so that left them unprepared for all of this stuff. So I would see Fyodorov as being like part of that response. He's deeply, deeply, deeply Christian. And he is struggling to find a way of responding to these new scientific perspectives at that time. But it's all falling apart. It's all going mad because there's no actual framework for understanding it. The reality is that the idea that we are somehow chosen and unique and special here on Earth simply doesn't gel with the reality of the cosmos as we know it. Yeah. Amy.
I'm just wondering about this new space agenda.
Yeah.
Somehow it feels like they have some sort of cult and esoteric
right.
agenda behind it, not just commercial.
Yes, yeah.
And it's very spiritual as well, the way the world has shifted.
Yeah.
Very rapidly, just over the few years.
Yeah.
So it's not only just dominance per se, like physically, but also like somehow spiritually.
Right. So I'll just repeat for those online. But Amy's suggesting that there's a spiritual dimension to this program in space and like how people are thinking about it and so on. And I would agree with that completely. And again, I would trace that lineage from the Russian cosmos through to the present day. You can have a look up ideas that they have ideas that they call the noosphere. So the noosphere is a like a field of consciousness that envelops the Earth. Okay. And so they have they believe there are people who believe that they have machines that can measure the noosphere.
Is it like ancient societies?
The Rosicrucians, yeah, and it's connected. It is. It's connected with these kinds of like New Age ideologies and things like that. Yeah, there's a significant overlap between Russian cosmists and New Age. Again, eugenics is one of the unifying features that's linking them. But that's getting into more complex. You can look at what's his name? There's somebody who's written about that. Yeah. Anyway, moving on. Okay. Sorry about that. I can't find it. Remember the example? Yes, please.
Hey, I thought it was interesting talking about the like setting up more and more satellites, more rockets into space.
Yeah.
You touched on it like super briefly at the start as well, how now like this is like a big problem globally is that there's no policy
right.
for space.
Right.
And now it's kind of like all this extra effort to go, okay, how do we manage
right.
all these rockets in space,
right.
which currently are mostly for commercial use. There's not really any utility that's coming out of it.
There's commercial and military, yeah. 3,000 military satellites at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, how are you supposed to enforce that? Because 6 months ago, debris or an old Chinese satellite crashed into a US satellite, intentional or not,
who's
to say, right?
Right.
And, you know, obviously...
It's the Wild West.
It is the Wild West, right? Yeah. Like, it is, you know, the next frontier, maybe space the final frontier. But, yeah, it's almost, like, to me, I'm thinking, wow, how exhausting, because now we have to now add governance to something that didn't need to be governed.
Right, right, right. And of course there are international agreements and there are, you know, policies and so on, but manifestly inadequate and not, I mean, the main international agreement, I think that governs it dates back to 1967 or something and is mostly talking about like national, you know, space programs and wasn't really thinking about commercial.
Yeah, because right now it's all commercial, right?
Yeah.
It's like they're just doing whatever the flip they want,
yeah.
as they would do anyways.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So it looks like we'll probably have to wrap up about now. I've gone a little bit late. So I did warn you it was going to be a slightly longer talk. But anyway, thanks, everybody. We should make sure we respect the workers at the center, make sure they get home on a Friday night at a decent time. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for staying with me. And thanks for going on this rather long and meandering journey through space and time. And hopefully that was interesting and informative for you all. And a little bit depressing. That's all right. That's all right. You can do some metta meditation. Okay. See you later, everybody.
Thank you.
No worries, mate.
If I've crossed the line in any way, I'm sorry.
No worries, mate.
Let me know if I do.
Okay. Thank you. Be kind. Be well. Yeah.
By the way, I met you 20 years ago at your monastery in London.
Really?
When I was at ANU, I came on a tour.
Oh, really?
So I only remember now.
Really? No, there you go.